Afternoon, everybody. Sometimes where you're just used to something, so we take precautions. Since we're used to eating bread with so many different items, meat, dairy, hamburger sandwich, so bread is not kosher if it's not parv. Okay, if bread is made with a meat product, or bread is made with a dairy product, I will say there are some hashkacha organizations that give hashkacha on milk and bread, but that's a compromise. Okay, right. So don't buy milk dairy bread. Right? If you see it says dairy K dairy. Now there could be an exception if it doesn't look like bread, like if English muffins, even though now most of them are parable. So, but okay, that's called hergel davar. But Hergel Dov is also why two people who are very friendly or siblings shouldn't eat one meat and one dairy, one right next to the other. But if you're eating next to someone with whom you're not so friendly, you're not worried that he's going to come over and take a piece of what you're eating. Right? Someone that you normally would share food with, that person you shouldn't eat right next to if they're eating something dairy and you're eating something fleishig. Okay. All right, so those are simple examples of hergel davar. Okay, what happens if someone did make a recipe for bread, and let's say it called for margarine, and then the person didn't realize, and the person actually put in butter? So in other words, I have this bread; it's perfectly kosher, or it called for almond milk, and you know, by accident I put in real milk. Whatever it is, it's something that was b'di'evet. I didn't mean to, but now I have this big loaf of bread here, and it's dairy. So there is a worse, which is to carve a big D in the bread. And after all, this is a kosher product. It's just I'm afraid that I will, because of hergel davar, because it's just something it's so commonly done, I'm just going to eat it with a piece of meat. But if I carve a big D in it, or maybe do something to it that makes it an inextricable sign that this I will not make a mistake, and I will not mix it with and forget what it is, then that's some post can call it. That's a way out. Okay, we're on page 113, which is separate utensils in the kitchen. Okay. All right. So we all know we have separate dishes and separate pots and separate silverware and separate glasses and cups. Okay. So there are basically three types of materials that go into our vessels. One is metal. Right, which is very easy to kasher. Right? Metal is a good conductor of heat and electricity, so it's also a very easy conductor to go between milk and fleishig. You can very easily absorb into metal, but you can also very easily exude and kibolo kach polko, says. The way it absorbs is the way it spits out, literally, the way it exudes the meat or dairy or something that wasn't kosher. So it's very, very, it's always preferable to have a metal sink, a metal dishwasher, whatever it is. Those are very easy to go from one to the other, very easy to kasher. On the other end, there is an item that we often have in our homes, which is impervious to any absorption, which is glass. Right? But there are very many different minhagim between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim regarding glass. Glass is harder than metal, and that's why we need a diamond to cut it. You can take a very sharp, like a box cutter, and try to run it across glass. It's not going to scratch it, assuming it's not very thin glass, but how hard you're pressing on it. But be that as it may, you can see that the glass doesn't absorb. If it did, you'd be able to see it. You'd see the particles, right? It doesn't absorb the meat, but what can happen to glass, and this is something Ashkenazim are very, very may explain the concern Ashkenazim have, is that there could be some mamashes left on the glass. Like you're eating a fatty piece of meat, and then you take a drink, and some of the mamashes from the meat is left on the glass. You can see the glass is not squeaky clean. What is that on the glass? So it could be that technically speaking, if you have a glass, you can put in boiling hot cholent in that glass and spoon it all out, or boiling hot fleshik soup, and then clean it out well. And then 5 minutes later, have a boiling hot hot cocoa with milk. Someone else, of course, not you, because you're flacious. But because the glass does not absorb, right? So, even with this in mind, some people have glass plates for this reason, right? So technically speaking, if you have glass plates, you can use it from both milchiks and flacious. It's not a good idea because we've gotten so used to having two sets of dishes. But technically speaking, glass has this leniency because it does not absorb. But nonetheless, Ashkenazim have what amounts to what looks like a big chumrah is that glass does need to be kashered, and the way to kasher it is called milui ve'iruri. Milui ve'iruri, not even with hot liquid, but that you just fill it with liquid to the top and let it stand for 24 hours. Right? And you do that three times. This is, some people do to kasher glass for Pesach. Okay. In the middle of these two, meaning metal and glass, is porcelain, china, that's a very difficult thing because those things absorb, but it's rather impossible to exude from them. If it absorbs, because by the nature of porcelain and earthenware, it doesn't it will pollute something, of course, but it doesn't pollute to the extent that the halacha requires. So that's why we always, we say that the porcelain cup or something that becomes treif, we say either you only use it with cold, right, or use it now with a candy dish or something, this bowl or something like that, or that it has to be given away because it cannot be kashered. Right? So metal, aluminum, very easy to kasher. Glass, doesn't really need to be kashered, but if you run it through a cycle in a dishwasher, or you use something caustic on it like Ajax or Comet or some kind of a powdered cleanser, then whatever got on the outside, whatever mamashas got on the outside of that cup of that glass, no longer is considered food, to be sure. Okay, so these are the types of utensils that we're likely to have. And again, if you can have a kitchen, very few people have, I don't think, have metal plates, but we do have metal pots and pans and metal. If you can get a metal dishwasher, that's also preferable. And certainly now, what I see is quite popular is stainless steel sinks. That's always preferable to have, right? Not only that, now the buildings are built with the kosher consumer in mind. They put in two sinks. Very common in almost all apartments. Two sinks, even if they're together, and then you have like a top tray that slides over from one to the other, maybe. Or now it's very, I see that almost all over is two separate sinks, two separate areas. The milk in one area and flesh in the other area. And this is, Jews are good consumers, and we are, and therefore we our cultural needs, our halachic needs, are met by the people who want us as customers. All right, so the first halacha here on page 113 is, here it's the Ramah in Yerodea. Okay, so He says that the custom is already to have different utensils and to have some kind of defining feature. Some people put like a red band on the fleishig, or you know, a blue band on the milchig. He says that that's, or what you can do is leave one of them unmarked and mark the other. And he says that the custom is to leave the fleishig one unmarked and to mark the dairy one. Okay, whatever he says, don't move away from that custom. Okay, all right. So the Ramah just mentioned knives, of course, but he quotes here the Kaf HaChayim at the bottom of the page that says this is, of course, the case now for much more than just knives, but also for all of our plates and dishes and pots. What this excellent work does is that when it quotes a new source, in this case, the Kaf HaChayim, was very important posek for Sephardic Jews. And it gives some of his background. It was here and even to the next page. Okay.
That's fine.
Yes, all households have this now. Is that make sure that the milk and silverware are just very different. They look different. They have different designs. So then the people get used to one. You're not going to have them mixed up. Of course, if they keep getting mixed up anyway, then the family should make some kind of a safeguard. But I get the question quite often, is that I have a dishwasher. I only use the dishwasher for fleishigs, and I found the milchig spoon. Especially when a lot of people have non-Jewish help who was putting those utensils away. So that is often a question. Okay. The question is twofold. Did the milchig spoon absorb from the fleishig cleansing in the dishwasher? And did the fleishig spoon, did the fleishig absorb from that the little milchig spoon?
Right?
Yeah, so that's not a tera. But it's rather simple, and because there's a lot of fleishig, could be the fleishig leos. It also depends. I know in our house, though, the dishes that go in the dishwasher are clean, rather clean. We have a sprayer and we just do it quickly and clean them. It's relatively clean. There's not much mushrooms. We just want to get it squeaky clean. So that's what the dishwasher is for. But it depends on some people who mamish take the food off with food on it, and there's a food tray, and you see that there's a lot of food there at the end of each run. So that's fleishig, and it's hot, and it could get into that spoon. The spoon would need to be kosher in there. Okay. All right, so the Taz says something here that I think I might have mentioned in the past about requiring different salt shakers, one for milk and one for fleishig. Simple reason. We take the salt shaker and we sometimes put it right on top of the boiling hot chicken soup, or right on top of the pepper shaker, or right on top of the cheese omelet that's boiling, burning hot, right on the stove. So it's worthwhile to have a separate salt and pepper shakers. Okay. All right, so. There is a footnote here at the bottom in this recent sefer that came on Hilchos Kashrus that says that the Taz required that at a time where the salt shakers were a little different than ours, because our salt shakers have small little holes in the bottom and on the top, and whatever steam might come out, doesn't make an influence on the. On whatever is inside that thing.
I remember that because you take up your hand during the outside,
So he said this. There's no need to designate two, one for meat and for dairy, since one does not put food or one's hands inside. So there you have it.
Maybe yeah, that's the inside.
Yeah, if it gets close enough. So yeah, Anshe Maisa are Makbid, and I know we always had two different soul chicken. Okay. Then the Aruch HaShulchan says that there is a custom, and usually that custom is green. Blue is for milchiks and red is for fleishiks. And there is a custom to use to have some parv utensils, especially parv knives. When you cut an onion, you'd like to cut it with a parv knife, because if you cut an onion with a fleishik knife, the duchke de sakina, the pressing down of the knife, exudes everything from that knife, even if it's not a ben yomo, even if it's been used more than 24 hours before with fleishik, that knife goes into the onion, and slicing an onion with a fleishik knife makes the entire onion fleishik. Of course, the same is true for milchit. It makes the entire onion fleishik, and even the other end of the onion should not be used for milchik after slicing one end with a fleishik knife. Okay, let's keep going. Now we're going to be introduced to a very important concept in the laws of kashrus, which is ta'am ki ikar. Ta'am ki ikar, and most poskim hold that this is a Torah law, this is not a chomer midrabanan, but that it's a Torah law that says that they just to understand the two terminologies, is the two Hebrew words, ta'am, which means taste, ki ikar, which means the main food itself, the main food itself, right? Ikar, is the actual chicken. Tom is the chicken soup. The chicken soup is the taste from this chicken. Okay, there are for instance in halacha, if someone has a great momentary desire for food, but it's treif. There's no other food around, and they have what's called the Gemara calls a bulmus, and they're afraid that the person is going to faint and die if he doesn't get food. So the Gemara says, first, if just smelling the food will be enough to revive them, then give them the ta'am of the food. And if that doesn't work, then give them the food itself. It's Yerushalmi at the end of Yuma, and I've seen some explain this as a function of Yom Kippur. It's not. On Yom Kippur, Tom is definitely the same as the Ikar, of course. You're not allowed to eat. It doesn't matter what you're eating, whether it's Tom or Ikar on Yom Kippur. It happens to be a Gemara in Yuma, in the eighth parak in Yuma, but it's a Gemara that's referring to any situation where it's not a kosher food on Yom Kippur. It's an unkosher food. An unkosher food might have a different din on this inyan, that the ta'am is preferable to feed this starving person, the ta'am of the food before the food itself. Right? Now, does that prove that ta'am is not ki'ikar? Well, it depends on the we're talking here now about milchiks and fleishiks, right? The ta'am is like the ikar when it comes to fleishiks. Maybe the tam is not like the ikar when it comes to Yisra
Beheter. Well, I think that's very interesting. I can really talk about the people's perception rather than the halakha definition.
Yeah, this is part of the tshuva of the Rambaz, where if you have little extra time for this starving person, it's better to shecht an animal than give him a ready-made McDonald's cheeseburger. Because he wants to save his life, but he doesn't want to have the experience of eating. But look, if it's mamish, his life is on the line at this moment, and he's hired, he has to eat. I sometimes have difficulty trying to explain to a person you must eat Yom Kippur. Right? The famous story is Rav Chaim said, "I'm not being lenient in Yom Kippur. I'm being machmir on pikuach nefesh." Okay, so where do we learn this thing about Tam Ki Iker? So the law comes from Nazir, right? So look down here. You see, look at Pasuk Gimel here on page 116. And it speaks of the laws of the Nazir, and it says, Miyayin v'shechar yazir. Okay, I get that. Yeah, shechar here does not mean whiskey. Shechar here means an old wine. Okay. Technically speaking, a Nazir is allowed to have whiskey and beer. It's just not wine, not from the grape. Chometz yayin, you can't even have vinegar from wine vinegar. Chometz shechar, it's wine from vinegar from old wine. Lo yishte, you should not drink. V'chom mishras anavim lo yishte. Now, what does that mean? V'chom mishras anavim lo yishte. Which is, the Gemara understands to mean, this is the next source, number 7 in, right below it. Okay, right here. So mishras means something in which the wine has been soaked. Okay, like a piece of bread, piece of cake or something, right? So what's the point? Is that there's a certain amount of wine, of grapes or wine, that passes a threshold of violating the Torah and receiving the punishment. Right? For food, it's a kezias. For liquid, it's a revius. So if when the Torah tells a nazir, we don't want you to consume the shear of grapes, that shear can mitzaref between the bread and the wine in which it is soaked. Okay, if you soak a little piece of cake or bread into wine, right, you dip it in wine, take it out, you have a kezias of that bread. Now, it's not a kezias of wine, because it's mostly bread. That's also violating the Torah. Okay. You see, the term soaked comes to establish the principle of mishras, right? The legal status of the taste of a forbidden food is like that of its substance.
Is that true even if you can't taste the wine?
No, then it's not tam.
Well, it probably
broke
something, but let's say
you didn't put it there. So it's a huge cake or something. It has to have some of the time, otherwise, it has to have enough for that. Okay. So the reason why that we say that Tom Kiker is Doraisa is very simple from what we just did. It derived from a pasuk. All right, so that it has the trappings of a Durabanan, because when the Torah says not to drink wine, that means wine. It doesn't mean wine mixed in water and bread. But because generally we do not allow Isser to be mitzaref this way. Right? We don't say that if you have a half kezias of pork and half a kezias of crackers, then that violates the Torah if you have them and eat them all together. No.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fair question, because the concept of nazir has significant chumras for the simple reason that this thing is normally permitted, even to this nazir, it'll be permitted to him after 30 days, and right now we are. So we do that with Hilchos Pesach, also Hilchos Nida. The Torah establishes a lot of Lo Tikrav Legalo Servasa, as opposed to the other women, it says Lo Tigale Ervasa. Here it says Lo Tikrav Legalo Servasa, don't come close, because this is something that will shortly be permitted. So while it's forbidden, it becomes very forbidden. So I'm just fortifying your question. And my answer is a simple answer, is that the Gemara knows when is a binyan av, and the Gemara knows when it's not. In other words, there's some drushes, the Gemara in Ksuvis derives from when the sota It says, and then undo her hair. So it must be that her hair, this is a married woman, even though it's ironic because she's being accused of unchaste behavior, and we're learning hair covering from her. Right? So, but the same lashon is used by men, a man who's a mitzvah. No one says it's a doraisa for men to cover his hair. It says ufora es rosho. So I'm parshas mitzvah. So what it says in Parshas Maso by the women, so okay, the Gemara knows that there it teaches that the same lashon by a man does not. The Gemara will sometimes ask, why don't we learn it? So he says maybe it's a Xeris HaKasuf, or there's some other explaining the relevant factor in the parsha that makes us understand it differently. Okay, so here number 8, the Vilna Gaon. And here, number 8, the Vilna Gaon speaks about that this Tanakh is a Torah law, right? Therefore, it is a real interpretation, as opposed to a Nesmachta or something. Right? It's a Drasha Gemura. Okay? So this is an important paragraph right here. Let's read it. Right? According to this principle, even a small amount of flavor absorbed is still halachically significant, even if the original food has been removed. Right? There's no chicken in the soup. Right? If your flavor comes from a non-kosher food or from meat that was mixed with dairy, it can only be nullified if the amount is so minute that one can't detect the taste at all. Right? Right, but this is an important point. We know that the number is 60, right? Right? You need 60 times the item to be nullified if it's mixed in. But that's not the case if the taste is still recognizable. There's some things whose shear is much more than 60 because the nature of this food, like spices, curry makes its self tasted much more than 1/60. I mean, you put 1/60th of curry in a big you're going to taste that. So that's not buckled, but the way we started, I think one of our first classes said that the whole idea of nullification is that you want it to disappear. It's buckled. It's like bittul chametz. Ka'afra da'ara. I don't want this thing to exist. This milk that fell in my cholent, I want it to disappear. I want it to just desist. Right? But if it's something that by its nature doesn't desist, or because I want it. So a perfect example of that would be kalim. If I have one spoon that needs to be kashered, and it mixes with 100 spoons that look like it, I have to kasher all 101 of them. You don't say it's bottle. One spoon doesn't get bottled in 60 spoons because that spoon still exists. I want it to exist, but it doesn't get mixed in. Like milk gets bottled in a big cholent. Cream is going to get bottled in a big pot of meatballs. If I can scoop it out and get as much as I can out of there, fine. But this is why it's important to know that ein mevatel nisur l'chatchila. You can't just by design put 3 pats of butter in your cholent and say, well, that's okay. There's 180 times the cholent and the butter. Right? Because ein mevatel nisur l'chatchila, it's only if you're walking past the cholent and the butter that you have in your hand that accidentally falls in. Then figure out these numbers.
That person now you gave up a spoon is like very important because I think people answer.
Yeah, they said. Well, this is also why there are certain things that are not butter, like chaticha haruyali hiskabed, the terminology chaticha haruyali hiskabed, which means that a good piece of steak or veal or something that you would normally place in front of an important person that doesn't get bottled. Even in 100 pieces that look just like it, because it doesn't have the trappings of bottle. Right? This might give musr, might give a new meaning to bittul Torah. Bittul Torah just nullifies it; it makes it disappear. You just spent the whole year learning, and this act of yours, this terrible, shameful act, just wiped it all away, like the chametz that's burning in the fire on Erev Pesach. Or I should say, what we say while we're kochamir v'chamir. So bittul is balev. So over here, you know, it's the status, as it says here in this number nine, is determined by the taste, so that even if it is batel b'shishim, but the taste is still recognizable, you still have trouble there. Okay, so that's a quote, but it's min b'she'eno mino. One thing that doesn't taste the same. If it's min b'mino, right, you know what I'm saying? It's one is a treif meatball, one is a kosher meatball, and they taste exactly the same, then the taste, of course, isn't going to change anything. Taste is the same. You get it? All right? This might not, you know, we get min b'mino like this to be with tithed items that got mixed with untithed items. Because it's the same fruit, it's the same exact thing. It's just that one is edible, one is not. Okay. Now there is an opinion in the Gemara by Rabbi Yehuda that says min b'mino eino batel. Dam minim batel dam. You know, something cannot nullify its own thing. Because they taste the same. How can you nullify the same taste? You get it? We don't paskin that way. Right? When it's min b'mino, you just need 60. You don't have to worry about taste. Of course, the taste is not going to be recognizable. It's the same taste. Right? You get it? Okay. Right, so let's take a look at the I think these things are I'm just going to go straight here to number 12 to this case as an example of here 12 of something that by its nature can't be made bottle because it says a piece that's not suitable for honoring. Right? So that means that I don't mind it being bottle. It's not an important piece of meat. It's just, it just disappear with everything else. But a piece that I would put in front of an important person, right? Now that's going to be different. That's going to be, and I don't want that to be bottle. Okay. So, now let's talk about the common mishap. The pot, the spoon, food, and fire. Okay, the heat. There's heat involved, all right? You mistakenly put a dairy spoon, that was benyomo, we're always talking about benyomo here, into a pot in which meat was cooking. Right? So you're mixing the hot, boiling hot meatballs with a milking spoon. So whatever goes is polate, whatever is niflat, whatever is exudes from that spoon into the dish, into the pot, whatever it is. Okay, so the spoon, you know, is going to be for good, right? Why? Because the spoon has dairy bleos, and now it has fleshy bleos. Got it? So the spoon is basa v'cholov in it at the same time. Okay, spoons are easy to kosher, no problem. What about the food? So I would tell you, you have to really work hard at messing up food. Right? It has to be really messed up, right? Because usually you're talking about quite a bit, a lot of food, and whatever comes out of this spoon is certainly going to be less than 60th of whatever comes out of the food. Okay? So it says, in this case, we must evaluate whether there is a ratio of 60 to 1. Okay. Right? Now, so this is an easy one. That's a dairy spoon in a fleshy pot. But what happens if I did something more serious? I cooked dairy in a fleshy pot. Okay. Yes. Okay. So there you too. You have to be careful, because some pots you say, well, that was clean. It's just tam that comes in from the walls of the pot. But some pots are mamish, not just tam. Some people don't clean the pots so well, you know. Right? You can see the mamashas at the bottom. It's discolored, maybe, or you know, things like that. But sometimes pot covers. Okay, so what happens if someone cooked milchik in a flesh of pot? Right? So you have to do the same thing. See if it was bottle b'shishim. Okay, take a look at the next source. John 20.
The pot was bigger than a spoon, so.
Yeah, so a lot can go. A lot more can go in. Post can require that is as if though the whole wall has something in it. Okay, so this is the Gemara in Chulam. Okay, that's how it's done. Okay, k'dei reshav bishal b'basar lo yivashu b'cholav bishal b'nosin tam. Okay, you see if it imparts flavor. Okay, the Shulchan Aruch says here in Siman Tzadik Gimel in Yerodea, it says, "V'im bishal ba besoch meis lais, aser benosin tam." If they cooked it together within 24 hours, that's always the question. First question any posek asks is, when was the last time you used this pot? When was the last time you used this spoon, whatever it is? Okay. This was
the pot and the dairy.
Hmm.
Both the food and the pot now. If you cook dairy in the pot.
So usually the food, you know, it might depend. If it was used within 24 hours and it maybe had mamoshes in it, besides Tom. But not dafka. It could be a lot of food, you know. I know generally when someone cooks when someone fries a cheese omelet, let's say, and they realize it was a flesh of pot, it's a small amount, so they're just gonna throw it out. But if you, let's say, you made a big milch quiche, a big pan or something, and you realize, oh my goodness, there's a flesh of, so it could be that it's bottled. This could be bottled whenever comes in.
The utensil
definitely needs compassion. The utensil has flesh of glios even from before 24 hours, and now it has another glios, so that's a big problem. So, so now this little section here in the middle on page 120. So it says, in general, there's rarely ever bittul b'shishim in either of these cases for cooking in the wrong type of pot, inserting the wrong type of spoon in the pot. As the ratio of the surface of the pot to the food or utensil is usually much greater than 1 to 60, and it does not be bottle. It might depend on what kind of pot you have. Beis Yosef says this. Mashma de'en b'mash b'soch ha'kli shishim k'neged kol ha'kli. Right. So what's the burden of knowing that? Most people are able to think back and say, oh yeah, no, I haven't used this in 2 weeks. It's not just using it, it's using it with boiling hot flesh. It doesn't count if you cooked macaroni in water the day before. Right? It has to be with flesh. You know, rove cases of Amy Binyam, which means that if you're not sure, you know, you can.
Yeah.
Because if you did use it with Binyam, you would have remembered.
Yeah.
Now, it could be that someone else, someone else in the house cooked with this thing. So that's why you don't know. You're not the only one who cooks in the house. And the household, of course. All right, but, so now he says, another common mishap is where you put a fleshy pot cover on a milk pot. It's cooking, and you're cooking boiling hot meatballs, and you put a milk cover on top. Now, that's strange. I know we have none of our milk pots fit on any of our fleshy pots. But if someone did mix it up, so take a look at one here in 121. In the Kol Kisui Rosech Mikaderish Abasar Vanasna Osar Kaderish Afarlov, right? You took a hot lid from a meat pot and placed it on a dairy pot. Okay. Im Shneim Chamim Shneim Asurim. Right? They can both be made forbidden. Each one will forbid the other. The food at the bottom, of course, makes the bigger influence, bigger effect.
Is he assuming that the vapor is considered as if the city is time.
Yeah. Steam, yeah. Now we'd be passing Reach Lav Milsehi.
Yeah.
But this is more than Reach. This is in that short distance between the top of the food and the pot cover. This is more than just Reach. This is like splattering. This is. Pimukah demands that even if the lid has not yet become hot enough to be out, so let us both, if it has begun to steam, it is forbidden. In other words, the steam can be rising even if the pot itself hasn't gotten so hot. That's the point, is that it was bubbling for a while, and now you just put the pot on top. It's going to take a little bit for that to get. Right? Which gets us, of course, to the next topic would naturally be nosin tam ufgam and utensils that are eino ben yomo. Utensils that have been used more than 24 hours away. And it's nosin tam ufgam, which means that it's ruining the taste. Right? First and foremost, when something's forbidden in the Torah, it has to be something that's tasty. It has to be something that's something that's edible, something that people eat, right? The Gemara here, it's cited below. It's on page 123 at the top. Okay. It assumes that after 24 hours, any taste that remains in the pot is considered impotent based on the principle of nosin tam ufgam. So if one cooks dairy in a meat pot that was not used in 24 hours, the dairy food in the pot is permitted. But what about the pot? The pot still has to be kashered, chatchila, right? Because the pot has more than 24-hour-old blios, right? And now some milk blios, so that's not a good situation.
Well, we want to do that anyway, because otherwise you'd have to
kosher anything. Now, some people wait 24 hours before putting something in the oven. Like they'll make some fleshig item in the oven, and they'll wait 24 hours to make machas. You know what? If the food splatters and the food's fatty, right, and it steams up in the oven, it's 24 hours. It doesn't help you. And if the food is like let's say a milchik cookies together with a fleshik bread, the same, everything fleshik, maybe veal, I don't know, things that don't really splatter, don't make them. Dry, grilled chicken without any gravy, no sauce, no you know, nothing. So those two, even at the same time, is not a problem because they're not absorbing one from the other.
Right? Thanks for saying that.
Okay. The reason this here it says the reason Chazal instituted the decree concerning using non ben yomo is explained in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, because then people get confused. In other words, like you just said, is that just have an eino ben yomo closet is where, you know, after I have here when I'm just use something and I'll leave it there. And then 24 hours later, I'll put it in my inner binyomo closet, and then I'll use most of the places together. It's all. Kulan shenishtamesh bahen ad shelo yatpil v'shelo yagil v'shelo yavein. So here, this is a Gemara that conflates a lot of the halachos of tefilas kelim and kashering kelim, because when we fought against the Midianites, the Torah gives us a whole litany of directions about how to make them usable. Right? So it's an interesting question, if I may just parenthetically ask. That war against Midian is not the first war we fought. There are wars fought in Parshas Chukas, in Sichon, against Og, against Chorma. There are wars that we fought there. Why didn't Moshe teach those laws there? We weren't told not to take spoils there. Some of it took spoils. Why only in the Midianite war are we told these laws? Do you acknowledge the question? So the answer, I think a simple shot answer, is that those being part of the land of Israel have tribes. What would have happened if Reuben and God did not ask for that land? Yeah, it would have been allocated to tribes. Maybe they would have asked who wanted to go there, but they asked, okay. So that land, and Menashe, some of Menashe's descendants fought, so Moshe might have felt it's only right to give some of Menashe, but not all of Menashe, give half and half. So that's a pshat answer of why Menashe was brought in at that point. So half of Menashe. So if it was a war for the conquest of what ended up being Eretz Yisrael, so that's a Gemara in Cholim that says that for the 7 years of Kibush Haaretz, they weren't makbil, I feel kosle de chazire. The tarfas move. The beef jerky that the clans left behind.
So
Midianite
wasn't part of that
100 years. Right, so the Midianite battle was far away. I'm not about Kibush Eretz Yisrael. So Kibush Eretz Yisrael, there's the regular laws of kashrus is going to kick in. And it does seem that if you have to kashrus something and tobel something, right, you bought it at the garage sale or something, that's from an aunt who wasn't kosher or something, you have to do the kashrus first. As if though maybe the kashering is like almost like acts like a chatzitza. How can you tovel something that needs kashering? It's almost came out like it's not mumdus, but so that is a source number 30 total.
Well, it's not really conducive to do. Make for
attempts at the idea. So the reason why we need separate dishes and we don't have a like eino ben yomo closet is it's very simple. To the last line on page 123, right here, it says mikan ve'elach lishtrig. No, zera kedera she'eino bas yoma mishum kedera bas yoma. We make a decree for the not to use the pot that is 4 days old because then you'll mix it up with a pot that's 4 hours old. Okay. You see the way Rashi explains it. It's in the second paragraph, number 21. Here. Okay, we're not a worshiper cooked today, but if you cooked him yesterday, the taste has already become stale overnight, and when it is later expelled into the food, cooked into different food, cooked food, it is only to the detriment of the other food. And therefore it won't be made forbidden. Okay. So from after that point, look what he says. Lishtrei af l'chatchila. Okay. But the pot itself would require to be kosher. Tosu says midrabanan. Okay, so you see the Tosfos in the Sechas of Zahara, see, right here, so it's number 22. Okay, it says, Makan Ba'elach Lishtere, Helkach Tavar Mavushal, Kli She'ena Ben Yomo, Mutter. Okay, something that was cooked in a non- Ben Yomo. So it's mutter. Well, this is the difference between Chatchila and Bedieved, but the food itself that was cooked in it did not absorb anything that made it forbidden. Right? This is a very common question. People should still ask. What if the spoon is not a ben yomo? So the food in the pot are going to be permitted, right? Because the spoon never put anything in there. That's also. But the d'eved, right? It doesn't make it also, since it was not a ben yomo. Right, which implies that if this thing can be used from now on with power, right, or in other words, not to be used by any with anything that right, the spoon that I use to stir in a fleshic pot, right, it's the shach says it's forbidden, it's permitted to use it with power. But the Prima Gaudim says the Prima Gaudim said, according to the strict halacha, but according to the custom, even the other items are forbidden. Moshe Kosev Arav Bahagosi Hey, the Osrin She'ena ben yomo afilu l'shar dvarim. Even if it's not a ben yomo, you still don't use it for other things. Now I hinted before about a pot that was a bowl that was trafed up that you could put in your break front and put candies in it. But he's worried about that because someday you may empty those candies and then you use that bowl again for a hot soup. Now by that time it won't be a ben yomo anymore. But the chatchila, we're not machalik. The chatchila, we don't do this for ben yomos. Okay, so we're going to talk about the kalim, stam kalim. What happens if you don't know one way or another? And then we have some interesting points about glass dishes, which I hinted at before, and some of the new approaches to our kitchens. Counters, sinks. Okay. Have a good day, everybody. Stay strong, stay warm, stay healthy.